When we started our study with this idea that chapter 8 would deliver us from fixating on chapter 7, because most of us do more identify with the idea that the good that I wish I do, I don't do, and the practice the very evil that I don't wish. The whole focus there is on this issue of the Spirit, but it's been interesting to me that you have verse 4, walking according to the Spirit, and that's really the issue here, but it's been interesting as I've delved into some of these things that he's been saying, that his big thrust is on what we believe about the coming future. Because the mindset on the flesh is death, but the mindset on the Spirit is life and peace. That's verse 6. And the whole issue then, verse 16 and 17, that the Spirit bears witness with our spirit that we're the children of God. And if children, then heirs of God, and then heirs of Christ if we suffer with him, so that we can be glorified together with him. And this issue then of verses 18 and following, which we are currently looking at, have to do with the present time in relation to the future that is revealed. So the focus is fundamentally on just how much of the revelation that the Spirit has given to us about how the future is affected by the present. There's a huge focus on that, so that we need to buy into, like verse 18 says, I consider means I have bought into this, the way I look at things. And as we've been looking into this, we looked last time at our perspective of creation in verse 19, that the creation eagerly waits. The creation is being turned into as if it was a sensible creature. The trees, as Hazel mentioned the day while I was talking to somebody, that the trees clap their hands. Well, trees don't have hands and they don't clap. But the imagery is that you're turning the creation into an anthropomorphism where it's like creation's human, and it has this anticipation of the coming glory, and particularly the glory that is to be revealed when the sons of God are shown to be what their future is supposed to be. We don't know what we shall be as the sons of God, but we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him. And the issue of being like him has to do with being glorified together with him, sharing in the glory that is his. And what does that really mean? And Paul never really comes right out and says, because he says the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared to the glory that's to come, and eye hasn't seen and ear hasn't heard the things that God has prepared for those that love him. And since eyes haven't seen it and ears haven't heard it, there's any way you can really discuss it with any kind of understanding. It's just beyond us. But the beyond us thing is supposed to be so fantastically desirable that we buy into it. And so the perspective of creation as a settled mindset that's looking forward but accepts the reality of the distance between what's been promised and what's being experienced. The point is, we have come in our study this evening to look at some more of the details as they are developed in verse 20. The creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but because of him who has subjected it in hope that the creation itself will also be set free from its slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. So the creation is going to share in the benefit of the sons of God having this thing revealed as to what they're going to participate in. Apparently, just as Adam, when he sinned, plunged the entire creation dragged the whole creation into bondage to corruption, when the sons of God are brought to their place in inheriting glory, they're also going to bring creation into the same freedom. So it's all tied up. It's all a great big ball where everything's tied together, and Paul wants us to be focused, fixated on this eager looking forward to what has been promised. And the reason partly for that is the creation's anticipation, verse 19, is rooted in the fact that it's in a sorry condition right now. It's been subjected to futility. So the King James uses the word vanity. Futility is another term, or another English word, for trying to get the idea across. But we're going to look this evening at verse 20 in this being subjected to vanity or futility, not voluntarily. It didn't choose this, but it was subjected on the basis of the person who subjected it in hope. So all of creation, all of God's creation, has been subjected to this vanity futility thing. And the emphasis really, if you were to read it out of the original text, it was for to vanity or to futility the creation was subjected, which means the focus is on this vanity thing. And when you look that term up, you get the definition of emptiness, something that's basically a big void. And yet, when you talk about a big void, you have to understand that a big void is not a total vacuum. There's no such thing. A big void is a void of something specific, but not exhaustive. When I looked the term up in Liddell Scott, it defines it in terms of frustration. The idea that the creation was subjected to frustration. And the issue of frustration is a pretty good idea, or gives us a good English concept. Strong says it's inutility, and inutility is in sage, but you don't find inutility in the dictionaries where the spelling is, because it's so rarely used. But inutility means it's useless. Frustration means that you want something you can't get to. Frustration is really an easy concept for us to grasp, because you only get frustrated whenever you want to achieve something, or you want to obtain something, or you want to do something, and you're blocked somehow. I mean, it can be as small a thing as trying to tie your shoes with gloves on, and you can't get the loops to stay in place. And you just get frustrated. You jerk your gloves off so you can tie your shoestring. Or it can be as small as trying to get a nut to screw onto a bolt that's in a hard place to reach, and the silly thing simply will not connect. And you just get more frustrated the longer you work at it. It can be planning a special dessert, and you put it in the oven, and it burns. It doesn't really matter what the particulars are. Everybody understands frustration. It's just having this objective or this goal that you want to achieve and somehow being blocked from it. And it just makes you frustrated. Well, the two concepts of frustration and inutility are linked by the reality that the vanity, the futility, is emphatically an emptiness of the specific thing called the ability to do it, capacity. You only get frustrated when you can't do it. So being subjected to futility means that you're subjected to having a whole bunch of desirable objectives that you can't achieve. And the whole creation was subjected to this emptiness of capacity, this lack of ability to make life be what the creation wants it to be. Whether creation is anthropomorphically used as illustration, or whether you're talking about human beings that want something and they just simply can't get there from here. And it starts off very young in life when a baby can't get something that it wants. It's howling frustration. It's just basically the inability to achieve whatever goal you're pursuing. So for the creation to be subjected to this futility or vanity means that we're in the midst of having been dragged down into a situation where there are going to be a lot of things we would like to see different than they are, and there's frankly nothing we can do about it. Now, the human thing about that is to come up with a whole bunch of meaningless cliches about, oh, if you just have enough determination, you can achieve whatever. That's just nonsense. There is some reality to the fact that if you try harder, you may be able to achieve something. But trying harder doesn't always work. And the very fact that you're trying harder sometimes actually makes it worse, because the more tense you get, the less able you are. And it can be that kind of a thing. And frustration is simply that. in utility simply means that whatever the methodology is, it's not working. The goal may be a lousy goal, but you can't achieve it. It may be a very worthy goal, but you can't achieve it. Whatever methodology you're using lacks the very essentials that make a methodology effective. So the whole creation has been subjected to this reality. Now, it's really interesting that he actually talks about what that reality is in more detail in the next verse, because the issue is slavery to corruption, bondage to corruption. That's the vanity. The idea that you can't achieve it is because you're losing your ability to pursue that with any kind of effective method. You've been subjected to a disintegrating reality that makes it impossible for you to maintain the level of energy or skill or whatever would be required to achieve the goal. And this specific concept of inherent inability, we need to think about, because there are some other qualifications. The vanity is observably successful in certain ways. For example, one of the objectives of the corruption, one of the objectives of the emptiness, one of the objectives of the vanity, not the objective of the one who subjected us to it, but the usefulness of it to the adversary, one of the objectives is to create the conditions of the frustration that is its very essence. In other words, one of the things that vanity does is create frustration. So it's very effective at that. And that means that our grasp of the vanity has to include temporary effectiveness in some of its objectives. And so the Bible says there's pleasure in sin for a season. That means there are certain things that you think you've achieved for a little while until you wake up and realize, no, you just dug the hole deeper. You didn't really achieve what you thought you had. You thought you had really achieved whatever it was you were after, but after a little while you realized, no, that was an illusion. What you did was you dug the hole deeper. And that goes in a lot of ways. There's a lot of illustrations of that. It's kind of like the guy that was committing adultery against his wife and told me that he'd never been happier in his whole life with his new relationship. And I just thought, well, I don't know that I thought at the time, but my reaction is, well, wait a little while till the bloom's off the rose, and then you'll discover that, oh no, I just dug the hole deeper. All of the reasons why I was pursuing this illicit thing I thought was going to make this happen, and no, it didn't make that happen. It actually made the opposite happen. And that's the whole idea. There's a temporary effectiveness in the vanity. It can create a temporary result that sets you up for even greater frustration later. So, this is the point of the text in our context. The sufferings of this present time are the direct results of the effectiveness of the vanity. We wouldn't be suffering if the vanity wasn't in charge. If there was no such thing as disintegration, the bondage to corruption, then we wouldn't be suffering, but we are suffering, and that just proves that the vanity is in charge in a very real sense. But those results, our suffering's results, according to this text, is that in the wisdom of God, the temporary successfulness of the vanity in making us suffer is not only ineffectual, but actually is being used by God to enhance the glory that's to come. So God is, in a very real sense, magnifying Romans 8:28, which we haven't gotten to. But the whole idea that everything that happens, bad, good, and indifferent, God is using to work together for our good. And that means that in His wisdom, vanity is losing every day. Every time it sets us up for frustration because we wanted something we didn't achieve and it upset us, and we realize that this is a part of the suffering that comes from being committed to the truth. God is taking that and enhancing the glory that's to come on the basis of that. This is the message of Easter Sunday. Friday, it looked horrible. Saturday, it didn't look any better. But Sunday, all of a sudden, everything was reversed. That's why Jesus said, now is the prince of this world cast out. He thought he won. He didn't. And the defeat was so great at Calvary that Satan knows now. Because the book of Revelation says that the beast, knowing that he only has a short time, he knows. He knows now that he has been defeated. But he's got his teeth, he's got his grip in, and he's hanging on tooth and nail to his methodology of trying to make the best of an enormously bad situation by dragging as many people down as he can possibly drag down. And knowing that he only has a short time left, he does as much damage as he can do. But even that is simply enhancing the glory that is going to come to those who are being subjected to this in hope. So, the inherent inability means that for a little while, the vanity appears to be successful. But over the long haul, God has already declared, no, the goals of the emptiness, the goals of the vanity are completely subverted by the grace of the wisdom of God. So the actual issue is, verse 21, where the vanity is identified as the bondage to corruption. The creation is subjected in hope, because it's hoping to be set free from its bondage to corruption and participate in the freedom of the glory of the children of God. And since the bondage is real, it's a slavery too, the effectiveness is real and not an empty thing. It's not a vain thing. The vanity, the inutility, the futility is not totally unable to do things, but it's unable to establish them as settled. It can create some turmoil in the process, but the very turmoil that's creating is actually counterproductive to its objective. Satan's last desire is for you and I to have enhanced glory because of what he's doing to us. That's his last desire, but it's God's first. So whatever you have to suffer, God's going to turn it into an enhanced, inexpressible glory, and therefore, but we do have to deal with the fact that the bondage is real. The creation is longing to be set free from it. The bondage to corruption is real, and that means that there is a temporal part or time when the corruption is the boss, and the actual meaning of the undoing of the order which God has put in place, that's what corruption is. It's undoing the order. The main illustration of the meaning of corruption is in the physical realm. The biblical statement is, from dust you came and to dust you'll return. God took the dust of the ground and he formed a man out of it, and he created a living being, a living soul, in a body with a spirit to energize it. And we became something that's just not dust-like at all. And yet it's from the dust. And the corruption, once the spirit departs the body, the corruption sets in really rapidly. And then there's this disintegration. And finally, through a whole bunch of processes, some of them pretty gross, the fact is you turn back into the dirt that you were made out of. And that's the meaning of corruption. It's the undoing of what God has done. And it's pretty clear that that's the meaning, because in Acts 2:27 and 31... Acts 2:27 and 31, there's a prophecy that God had told Messiah that he wouldn't let his body be turned over to corruption, that he would raise him from the dead before that could actually set in. And that's the whole idea, that the body of Jesus was kept from the corruption, which is the automatic consequence of death under the bondage to corruption. But resurrection completely reversed it. Just as an aside, Ravi Zacharias today was talking about Lazarus' tomb, and he didn't know if it was the real tomb or not, but the tombstone said, twice dead. Because he died, and he corrupted. His sister said, "He's going to stink. You roll that stone away." And Jesus said, "Lazarus, come forth." And he didn't stink. His corruption was instantly reversed, and he was healthy again. And yet, the corruption still set in later, and he died again. But that was a miraculous thing Jesus did in order to prefigure, to show forth a future reality where the reversal of corruption is going to be permanent. There isn't even going to be any disintegrating. I've often used the expression, in our bodies we have a built-in disintegrating principle. It's the body adjusts to the level of stimulus that it gets, and in the adjustment it demeans it. Drug addicts are drug addicts because when they take the first dose, they get a response that's really significant. But then over time, where they subject themselves to the same dose to try to get that feeling back, they discover that the same level of dosage won't bring it, so they have to raise it until they get that same reaction. Well, then after they've raised it, in a little while, the body is adjusted to that, and then they don't get the same response, so they have to raise it again. And in a little while, they kill themselves because they keep raising it, and your body simply can't take that kind of damage. But the point is, it's built in. And on the good side, your body can actually numb your pain by adjusting to it. And then you're not in as much agony as you would be if it didn't adjust. But by the same token, your body adjusts to the good stimuli too, and then you have a diminished return on that, and so you think, well, it's, you know, I thought that I'd get this kind of response, and I don't. And compare that to post-resurrection, going to the river of the water of life and taking a drink. I have this sneaking hunch that the taste of that water is going to be fantastic. And the next time you get a drink, it's going to be at the same level of fantastic. It's never going to get less fantastic to you, because there's not going to be this disintegrating capacity over time. The body is not going to be subject to corruption anymore. So the point is, the corruption that the creation has been subjected to, the corruption itself is the assumption that it can undo what God has accomplished, but the undoing is temporary because it's a part of the plan. And I say that because verse 20 says that the creation was subjected to this bondage to corruption, blending verses 20 and 21, not voluntarily. In other words, the creation didn't volunteer for this. The creation didn't say, "God, we know that in your plan there are certain things that have to happen, and they can't happen without the input of the corruption. There are certain things about life that can't be learned any other way. We understand that. We're going to volunteer to be subject to corruption." It didn't happen. The creation was blindly going along its way, saying, "Life's great. I love it." And, you know, the world was, the creation was. And then all of a sudden, something happened in the Garden of Eden. And Adam's action caused God to subject the entire creation that he had created for Adam's oversight. Dragged it right down into the process of being subject to the bondage. So then the creation would try to send forth good plants that would produce good fruit, and boy, all kinds of weeds grew up, and it choked the fruit, and the corruption of the goal sets the creation's teeth on edge because it wanted to accomplish something they couldn't. It's just on and on and on. And the whole issue is that Paul is trying to say, in a very real sense, that the creation didn't dream this up. The creation didn't volunteer for the plan. The bondage to corruption was set in place because, according to verse 20, of him who subjected it. The God who put creation under this bondage to corruption temporarily. And the whole issue here is, if you could blame this on the devil, if the he who subjected it could be turned into the devil, that'd be one thing. But it wasn't the devil, because he who subjected it did so in hope. He subjected it in respect to the promises he'd made about the future eventuality, so that, yeah, you're subject to this now, but it's temporary. Hang in there. The glory that's to come is going to be worth it, so just don't get all bent out of shape about it. And the whole point here is that God had a longer range plan. And it actually required the subjection of his creation to the experience of the corruption, the vanity, the inutility, the frustration. His longer range plan has always been declared in scriptures as a kingdom of righteousness, peace, and joy, based on the participation of the inhabitants in the life of God. The life of God is qualitative experience rooted in the knowledge of God, because eternal life is knowing him as a methodological tool. So if there are things you don't know about him to that degree, your methodology is flawed and you won't enter into the life to any significant degree. So God says, okay, we're going to make the fullness of life possible for the creation. And part of that means that they're going to have to learn some things about me that they're going to consider during the process of being subjected to creation or to corruption. They're going to learn some things about me that they're not really going to like. They're going to learn about wrath and justice and holiness and some of these kind of things that end up putting sinners in a pinch. So, the kingdom of righteousness, peace, and joy rooted in the experience of the life of God by the those who believe him, that meant there had to be a more solid foundation than simply creating sensate beings, a personality, and a state of moral innocence, because that's what he did in the beginning in the garden. Adam and Eve were created in a perfect environment with innocence as their norm. And yet, he put a tree in the garden, called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and said, in the day that you eat thereof, you will surely die. And set that up. And then Lucifer, who had already corrupted the angelic realm with his rebellion, came into the garden and seduced Eve, and then in a blatant way challenged Adam, and Adam capitulated. Paul says Eve was deceived, Adam was not. So Adam actually capitulated in the face of Lucifer's argument. So the creation in the heavenlies, Lucifer corrupted, and the creation on the earth, Adam corrupted. And this is part of the solid foundation that God laid in order to reveal certain things about himself that would enhance the life and the experience of glory for those who would be willing to do exactly what Adam did not do, and that is trust him. The whole thing was rooted in the flaw of unbelief. And that's why the last two words in verse 20 are in hope. Because the issue of hope is the issue of expectation rooted in confidence. That's what faith is. Confidence. You believe this, that means that certain things are going to be the result of your believing, and that's called hope. So faith is the evidence of things hoped for. It's the foundation for them. And when he subjected it in hope, that means at the same time that he was subjecting it to this corruption, he was telling them, look, this is temporary. We talked about that last time, about how Enoch knew it was temporary, about how Josephus said that Seth knew it was temporary. It was going to go through a cycle of a virgin-born son who would come into the world and be all of these things that are symbolized by the symbolism of the zodiac, and it would end with the line of the tribe of Judah coming back the second time to establish this kingdom of righteousness, peace, and joy, which assumes that the subjection to corruption has accomplished its objective. The time is pretty much up. Now, I say pretty much up because the biblical picture, even of Messiah's reign on the earth, is that it lasts 1,000 years and ends in a wholesale rebellion on the earth. The armies of the whole earth marshal together around Jerusalem and around the king, and then fire falls from heaven and just wipes them all out. So even the reign of Messiah on the earth is still subject to some degree to the corruption, but it's not caused by the devil because he's in the bottomless pit, and it's not caused by the environment because Christ is the King of the kingdom, and the environment is righteousness, peace, and joy. It's caused by one thing, and that is the condition of human fallen beings. And it's rooted in whether or not they're going to believe what God says is true. Even during the millennium, when Messiah says something, people are going to either have to believe him or not. Over 1,000 years of time, the corruption of the human reality is going to cause more and more of them to not believe him and actually to rebel in hatred against him, so that at the end of that time, there will be a final dealing with human depravity. And then comes the end. So, it's a backdrop of hope, but the point of the hope is creatures have to learn from their experience. Learning from their experience means that they have to believe in the future of the glory of God. They have to believe what God says. When God says, in the day you eat it, you shall die, and Satan says, no, you won't die, that's an obvious difference of declaration, and you have to believe something. So the bottom line is, are you going to believe God or not? And that's still the bottom line. I mean, today, we have more people who pay no attention to what the Word of God says, and yet they call themselves Christian. And a lot of them don't call themselves Christian. They have no regard for what the Word of God says. But God said it. It's going to be this way. There isn't anything they can do about changing. They can marshal all of their PhDs and all that kind of stuff and say, well, we're more intelligent than you are and we know better than you do and all that kind. They can even talk about the arrogance. I read about the arrogance of Christians who think that their way of looking at things is the right way. That's not it. It's the arrogance of those who reject what God says, this is the way it's going to be. It's more arrogant to deny God's declaration than it is to believe it. So those who believe it are not the ones who are being arrogant. It's those who reject it. But the point is, this is a whole part of the process of learning from our experience. And the book of Hebrews actually declares that the Messiah himself, in his humanity, learned from the things that he suffered. So suffering is a part and parcel of the learning experience of limited capacity creatures. We're never going to be omni-anything, and therefore, we're always going to be deficient. We're always going to have a need to believe what we're told by somebody who isn't deficient, and that means that there will never be a lack of necessity for taking God at his word. So that's why God subjected it in hope. He says, yes, it's bad now, and yes, I have subjected you to this evil stuff now, but I did it with this goal in mind in the future of this extraordinary experience of the glory that's to come. And so I'm just asking you to trust me. The glory is coming. It's going to be yours. Just trust me. Believe me. And the hope is that God, the God of creation, who subjected the creation to this temporary insanity, will actually accomplish the undoing of the adversary's vanity. So that whatever the adversary has claimed he could do, he's going to be proven to not be. You know, one of the most amazing things about the declaration about the eventual condition of the adversary is that when he is in hell, Gehenna, the lake of fire, people are going to say, is this what caused all this trouble on the earth? This is the one that caused all this? And they're going to say it in a scornful, laughing kind of thing. And I've discovered from observation that the worst thing you can do to an arrogant egotist is laugh at him. And that's his final condition. And the outcome is that God is going to undo everything the adversary has done. In his attempt to undo what God has done, God is using his very actions of attempting to undo to magnify his accomplishment in the context of the freedom of the glory of the children of God that is coming. And he's going to do it. That's Paul's whole point. He is going to do it. Now, it's not without its problems. Because verse 22 and following identify the fact that the time is not pleasant now. The bondage to corruption is not something you can just blow off as inconsequential, because it's painful and it's difficult, but it's not permanent. And that's what he wants us to understand clearly. The creation itself is eagerly looking for the fulfillment of the promise, because it was subject by God to the corruption for a temporary period, but he gave them a promise ahead of time that it would be temporary and it would be reversed.